From WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ecce Homeris Americanus. In other words, behold the lobster. There's been a bumper crop of them this year, so suddenly lobsters are everywhere. But my guest today says, if you look closely, lobsters have always been everywhere. From sea life to still life, they parade through our masterpieces, our poetry, our art. Freud called them sex symbols. Dali turned them into hair pieces. Alice danced like them in Wonderland. This hour on Point, in myth, art, science, and on the plate, the secret lives of lobsters. You can join the conversation. How do you know your lobster best? Is it all butter and rolls for you? Or have you seen them in art and wondered why they're there? Comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is author Nancy Fraser. She spent more than 6 years buried in lobster lore, and the result is the new, wonderfully whimsical book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. Nancy Fraser, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Let me start with what may be the most obvious question, but why lobsters and why 6 years? What made you fall in love with them so?
Well, it all started in 2001 when we bought our house on the Medomic River, which is a tidal river in Maine. And lobsters were invisible, as they usually are, but signs of them were everywhere. The river just bobbed with lobster buoys in various colors, and there were constantly lobster boats going up and down the river. And the life of the river depends, it seems, entirely on lobsters. And even when they're not there, their presence is felt because it's the mist. I mean, they migrate as the winter comes on, and suddenly the river gets very quiet, and there's nothing so obvious as the missingness of lobsters.
So the absence of them was even as profound as their presence. Interesting. I mean, that makes a lot of sense living in Maine, which is lobster country in the United States, but and yet you took this sort of observation and this passion and turn it into 6 years of investigation. I mean, what did you find? Where are lobsters?
Everywhere. They from ancient Rome, you can see them on wall paintings. Throughout history, you can find traces of them and stories about them, legends about them in antiquity. And they're still going strong today.
So tell me a little bit more. You went on a hunt, and you searched for them in artwork. I mean, as you mentioned, they're in so many places. But let's focus on art a little bit. And I wonder if we could do that through hearing a little bit from your book, from an early part of the book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey, where you talk about your growing inventory of lobster-based artwork.
Yes, I got to say also that at the same time we bought the house, I was a graduate student at the University of Massachusetts in art history. And so I was very much aware of works of art that had lobsters in them. But let me read the passage. And I was collecting, images of lobsters in art in my mind. And I didn't start doing it until after 2001 when the kind of invisible presence of lobsters was so persuasive. And I was collecting images and had a huge amount of lobster art. And the larger my inventory grew, the more I wanted, not just fine and graphic arts, but what about the other arts? Were lobsters interesting in literature, poetry? How about the movies, photography, the decorative arts? Yes, 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 yes. And yes, even high fashion, not to mention haute cuisine. Each of the arts makes its own claims on and has its own use for one of the strangest creatures to parade across the face of the earth, or more accurately beneath the surface of the sea. It scurries backward and forward on its five pairs of walking legs, the first two of which, on the lobsters we know best, are awesome claws that it raises in defense and challenge. It hides in dark places, protecting its territory, threatening everything from a passing lobster to a submarine. Backward and forward also describes the way that people characterize and feel about this creature, a relationship that surely parallels the human presence on Earth since lobsters preceded us here, and we had to try and figure them out, and we still do.
That's Nancy Fraser reading from her new book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. I love that passage because you sort of take us back. You begin to tease us with how far back in time the human-lobster relationship goes. Tell me a little bit more, because you write in the book about, for example, mosaics in Pompeii for the Romans depicting great, you know, massive battles between lobsters and an octopus.
Right. The octopus is one of the few but one of the major predators for lobsters. They can wind themselves around and sort of disarm the lobster. And this has been known forever in ancient Greece, where both lobsters and octopuses were always present. And there are mosaic tile floors and walls that portray these battles, these ferocious battles. The lobster, the lobster usually loses to the octopus. It's often a three-way battle between the eel, the octopus, and the lobster. Mm-hmm. And the lobster prevails over the moray eel, but the octopus, as often as not, bests the lobster.
I can only imagine that sort of the undersea fury of a three-way crustacean and cephalopod battle. You say that this relationship goes even further back, and I have to admit, I did not know this, that lobsters were deities in ancient Greece or deified.
Yes, they were, especially on the island of Seriphus, which is in the Aegean. It's one of the Cyclade islands. And it was believed there that lobsters were sacred. And it was said that no person was allowed to fish for, let alone kill a lobster. And if a lobster was found, say, on the shore, you should quickly put it back into the water. If it was dead, you should bury it, and they would mourn over it as if it was a member of the family.
A member of the family. Now, help us begin to connect some of the dots here. I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about how lobsters pop up in painting and in pop culture as well. But why deify or, mythologize in the early days a creature which is a bottom dweller, a bottom feeder? It's a crustacean. It's not something that, when at first glance, seems rather heroic.
Mm-hmm. I puzzled and puzzled and looked for some explanation for that. And I finally followed some clues that had to do with Perseus, who was an ancient Greek god, the daughter of Danae. Danae was banished. She was actually thrown out in a wooden cask by her father, who discovered that she was having a child because it had been predicted that if he had a son, the son would kill him. So he sent her off, she and the baby, off in a wooden box floating on the ocean, and they landed in Seriphus. And it used to be said that the lobsters were playthings for Perseus. As Perseus grew up and the king of Seriphus fell in love with Danae, Perseus's mother, he tried to get rid of Perseus so that he could seduce his mother. Mm-hmm. And he sent him off on a hunt for the Medusa.
The Gorgon, exactly.
The Gorgon Medusa. She is known to have turned people to stone if they look at her.
Her face with the snake hair was to be so hideous as to turn people to stone.
Right, and her eyes and it were, you know, evilly magic. So he took a shield that Athena gave him, and he went in search of her, had a long journey, a lot of adventures. And when he found her, he saw her image in the shield so that he didn't have to look at her. And he cut off her head, and he went back to Seraphos with his trophy. And when he got there, he soon discovered that the evil king had seduced his mother, and he, in revenge, held the Medusa head, which he had with him, and turned the king and many other people to stone.
Nancy Fraser, stand by here for just a second. I'm speaking with Nancy Fraser. Her new book is I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the surprising lives of lobsters and how one of our favorite seafoods may also be one of our favorite subjects in art, mythology, and literature. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And I'm joined today by Nancy Fraser. She's a lobster lover, art historian, and author of the wonderful new book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. Before the break, Nancy was telling us about how lobsters feature prominently in Greek mythology. But let's move forward in time a little bit, because they also feature prominently in pop culture and more than a few movies. Here's a clip. It's a classic sketch with lobsters from the 1977 film Annie Hall. Of course, that's Woody Allen and Diane Keaton playing Alvy and Annie. They're running around their kitchen shrieking as they round up loose lobsters crawling across the floor that are waiting to be cooked.
Come on, Alvy, they're only baby ones, for God's sake.
If they're only babies, then you pick them up.
Oh, all right, all right, all right. Here.
Oh, don't give it to me. Don't. Jesus.
Give it.
Talk to him. You speak shellfish. Hey, look, put it in the pot.
I can't put it in the pot. I can't put a live thing in hot water.
What do you think we're going to do, take them to the movies?
Here you go. Oh, good, Alvy, I'll say.
Take them to the movies or put them in a pot. I'm sure that's a situation that many listeners have gone through. So we're going to talk a little bit later about the act of putting a live lobster in a pot. But Nancy Fraser, talk to me a little bit about lobsters popping up in movies. I mean, such as Annie Hall. We're going from Greek mythology to modern day cinema. How did that happen?
Well, I'm not sure exactly where it started, but there's a wonderful Buster Keaton scene in The Navigator, where he goes down underwater to free the ship that's been stuck apparently by a wire down there, and he grabs a passing lobster and uses it to cut the line. And then there's something that ended up on the cutting room floor in which I've suddenly forgotten his name. Mm. He had lobsters reverse the whole scene in a restaurant where the lobsters are in the tank and people come in. Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
The people walk in. The lobsters walk in and the people lead them to the tables and they go to the tank and pick humans, but it ended up on the cutting room floor because nobody else thought it was funny.
You know, what's interesting to me about the movies that you just mentioned, and also Annie Hall that we just heard from, is that here in modern day cinema, we're seeing lobsters as food. And a little earlier, we were talking about lobsters in mythology. Mm-hmm. So, you know, interestingly enough, these creatures have sort of the history of our interaction with them very closely traces, a sort of economic line. Because, for example, in the eastern seaboard in New England in, what, the 17th century or so, lobsters were considered, according to Fred B., who commented on OnPoint's Facebook page, a peasant food. And that's a pretty interesting history. So who was treating lobster as a peasant food in the 17th or 18th centuries?
That was not a very long period of time, and I believe that it was mainly when there was a lobster glut, perhaps even more of a lobster glut, much more than there is now. And the problem is, if it's one of the cheapest foods around, it'll be fed to servants and incarcerated people. And I wouldn't blame them for complaining, because you can only eat so much lobster. Mm-hmm. It's such a rich food that you can get tired of it. But for the most part, I mean, even from ancient times, lobsters have been cherished and, as food, and have been upper echelon kinds of meals.
And perhaps most painstakingly captured in the paintings that you've reproduced in your book, I, Lobster, by the Dutch masters in the 17th century and even earlier. Tell us about some of your favorite lobster paintings.
Well, there's one right here in Amherst at the Mead Art Museum that I'm very, very fond of. And it's a hunt scene, actually, a still life of all these elaborate and rare creatures that have been killed, from peacocks to swans. And in the background, holding a great charger, is a bright red lobster in the arms of a servant, which is clearly the focal point of the painting. There are most of the 17th century lobsters are with still lifes, have imported fruits and beautiful, beautiful silks, and all kinds of symbols and symptoms of wealth. And they're kind of called memento mori paintings, or vanitas, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And they're warnings, actually, to not get over materialistic, because after all, you can't take it with you. So that's one side of the coin. It's, beware of eating lobster. It's such a luxury. And the other side of the coin, that's heads and tails, is carpe diem. Seize the day.
Eat it now.
Eat as much as you can now.
Listeners, we are talking about the secret lives of lobsters and how they show up in surprising ways, not just on our plates, but in paintings, in art, in literature, in poetry. Let's go to Ron, who's calling from Nashville. You're on the air, Ron.
Thanks, Magna, for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. What's your thought?
I grew up in Miami and the Keys, and we've caught lobster commercially my whole life, obviously less so since I've moved away. But I can see how it's been mythologized, and it's such a nice food. A couple of things about harvesting them, you guys are probably discussing the New England lobster variety, but we have a lot of spiny lobster in Florida,
exactly,
in the Caribbean. What I've noticed over time, when I was a kid, our harvests were so much more and plentiful. And even though they've sectioned off areas down there now for sanctuaries, which has helped tremendously with the population, at least in the areas that are sanctuaried off, the number of people now that go out, even though you have to limit the amount that are caught for people who don't have commercial licenses, it's unbelievable how many boats and how many people are out there now. And
they're out there for lobsters specifically?
Yes, specifically. Like mini season, the sportsman season, they have a two-day time where you can go out and catch. And when I was a kid, it was unheard of that a boat would come up right next to you and start swimming on the same small reef that you were on. And my dad was telling me that people are doing that routinely now. He's in his 70s and still goes out.
I imagine that's not doing the reefs any good if there's so much boat traffic.
Exactly. And my personal opinion is, even though they're so good and everybody loves them, it's one of those things that I think we have to consider our desire to consume these creatures, as well as preserve the other things that come with harvesting them.
Ron, I'm going to stop you there because I've got the perfect guest who can pick up your thought. Thank you so much for your call. Joining us now from Biddeford, Maine, is Diane Cowan. She's a marine biologist and founder and senior scientist at the Lobster Conservancy in Friendship, Maine. She's studied the lives and social behaviors of the American lobster since 1983. Diane Cowan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. So you were hearing earlier Nancy Fraser talking to us about the surprising ways that lobsters show up outside the water and in all sorts of other human endeavors, art, poetry. We'll hear a little bit more about that. But pick up where the caller just left off, that even though there have been, for example, up where you are in Maine, a bumper crop, we still love lobsters so much that we may be doing long-term damage to them, whether it be Maine or Florida. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, first, I would like to just say that there are different kinds of lobsters, the slipper, spiny, and clawed lobsters. And the spiny lobsters, the ones the caller was talking about in Florida, live all the way around the globe from 35 degrees north to 35 degrees south in latitude. And they're really very different. Their life cycle, their appearance, the way they behave is very different from the clawed lobster, which is the one I specialize on.
I suppose he was wondering more about how, I mean, for example, in Maine, the lobster industry is very closely regulated.
Right.
But for other places where maybe the regulation isn't so specific, I mean, he was worried about damage that people are doing when they're lobstering to the environment that these animals live in.
Yes, and that's a very worthwhile concern to have. We don't in Maine allow diving for lobsters and that kind of catch where you're actually going and taking them from their habitat in by hand.
Diane Cowan, Nancy Fraser, a couple minutes ago, was telling us some amazing facts about lobsters and mythology, for example. But there are some real-life scientific facts about the American lobster that you're most familiar with, which seemed almost mythological to me, even though they're true. For example, they can live to be 100 years old?
Well, we're not exactly sure how old they can be, but theoretically, lobsters can live infinitely. They grow throughout their lives, and there's no theoretical limit to how big they can get or how old they can get, but we don't have any way to age them, and of course they don't live forever. The record size that's been caught out of the waters is 44 and a half pounds.
44 and a half pounds.
And I would guess that's on the order of 100 years old, but we don't have any hard proof of that.
So for as long as they're alive, they grow?
Yes.
And this is because they are animals with an exoskeleton, so as long as they can shed that shell, they're good to go?
Right, but many crabs and other crustaceans have what's called a terminal molt. That's the last time they shed their shell, and then that's it, and they don't grow anymore. But lobsters have indeterminate growth, and they keep shedding their shell and getting a whole new external skeleton every time they do so, and they get new sensory hairs for smell and taste, and they regenerate missing parts, so they just keep renewing themselves.
Nancy Fraser, the idea that a lobster can potentially live infinitely, it can essentially reincarnate itself by shedding its shell multiple times, it can regrow limbs, that does seem to me to be the stuff of mythology. Is this part of the reason why you think that they've so captured our imagination?
Oh, sure. In fact, reminds me of a science fiction story about called the something, the Vanishing Hand or something. People have thought about lobsters' regeneration forever and have tried to duplicate it. And this is a science fiction story of a guy who actually dies because some doctor is trying to perform surgeries on him that will encourage his, he's lost an arm, and encourage a new arm. I'm sure that all of the everything about the lobster encourages fantasies. I mean, we see lobsters, and what we see, we apply to ourselves, and we bring them into our world. We don't see them where they live. We don't really see them what they're doing. And as Diane has written on her website, all of the understanding we have of the process of lobsters mating is learned from the experimental tanks in which we watch them. And we've never seen this in their natural habitat. And there's they mostly hide out down there. They walk around on the floor of the ocean or on the bottom of the river looking for food, but they're not social animals. Like the spiny lobsters are pretty social animals, but they don't have claws. I mean, they're more peaceable and more sociable. Our lobsters, Homerus americanus, are pretty violent by nature.
I'm hearing a lot of anthropomorphizing.
Aggressive, exactly.
Diane Cowan?
Yeah, I don't think that that's true. For almost 30 years, I've been watching lobsters in their natural habitat, and my early studies were in aquaria. But when you put the lobsters in a tank, you're putting lobsters together who don't know each other, and you get artifacts from that. But I've since taken to watching lobsters who are with the other lobsters they want to be with. They're just in nature, and things really work differently. I've seen no evidence of cannibalism whatsoever, and I've seen evidence that they are quite social and live not like the spiny lobsters who are really gregarious and go on migrations together, but they live in high densities, in groups, and the male and female pair bond when they mate. Males live together in shelters in winter. Juvenile lobsters, the smallest juveniles are more likely to live with other lobsters than they are to live alone. So I think a lot of what we've thought was true of the lobster, the American lobster, in terms of their being not very social or being cannibalistic, was because we were observing them in tanks and in unnatural situations.
Diane Cowan and Nancy Fraser, stand by, because we are indeed talking about the surprising lives of lobsters. I've already learned several facts about what's on my plate that I didn't know before. Diane Cowan is a marine biologist and founder and senior scientist at the Lobster Conservancy in Friendship, Maine. She's joining us from Biddeford, Maine today. Nancy Fraser is joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts. She's author of the new book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. And you're listening right now to a little bit of Philip Glass and his composition, The Lobster Bowl. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the lobster, the artist's muse, the lobsterman's hall, a real-life fascination. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And in fact, at Facebook, at On Point's Facebook page, Lorraine S. commented, I don't eat sea cockroaches. Also, these so-called, quote, dumb creatures know the scent of the ocean and begin to flap their tails when we are within 100 yards of the waves. I love setting them free. And over at onpointradio.org, the website, Kim writes, my brother are all lobstermen off the mid-coast of Maine. One of them has a large antique photographic print of several men posing behind an enormous pile of hundreds of lobsters in Belfast, Maine. Writing on the back of the photo explains that the lobster was caught and used as fertilizers for local farmers. So some comments and remembrances there of lobsters. And we're doing this because we're joined by Nancy Fraser. Her newest book is I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. And also with us from Biddeford, Maine, is Diane Cowan. She's senior scientist at the Lobster Conservancy in Friendship, Maine. Let's go to the callers because there are a lot of them. Liz is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Liz.
Hi, Meghna. I just wanted to say that I learned a really valuable lesson from a lobsterman in Maine of how to be really kind to a lobster before you pop it into the boiling water. And I have used this tool ever since. What you do is you hold the lobster and you rub between the eyes, much like you would be petting a cat. And you will see the claws just all of a sudden dangle down, and the lobster is so relaxed.
Okay, Liz, I have to ask you, I've heard about this before, so essentially you're hypnotizing the lobster? Have you done it?
Yes,
does it really work?
That's right. You're hypnotizing the lobster so that he told me, the lobsterman said, it's much less painful and a way of dying than, you know, popping it in without any preparation.
Okay.
And you can see how relaxed the lobster is.
Liz, thank you so much for your call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Let me turn that to our lobster expert, Diane Cowan. I have heard of this before. Liz says it works. Can you truly hypnotize a lobster before you boil it, Diane?
I don't know. I keep the eating of lobsters and the science and work of lobsters really separate. And I think the most important thing is to cook the lobster the way you like it and enjoy it to its fullest and be thankful that you have that delicious meal.
Well, I guess what Liz's call gets us to is this question that, you know, lobsters are the one thing which in people who do bring them home live, they are actually killing it, you know, in their homes, most often by boiling it in water, in hot water. Do they sense pain? Do lobsters have a sophisticated enough neurological system such that it causes them pain in the minute or so it takes them to die?
Their perception of pain, I figure, is very different from ours because you're talking about an animal that can lose its claw, drop its basically its arm right off, and the nerves and blood vessels shut off instantly. It has a nervous system that designed to stop sending pain signals when it loses a limb. So maybe that goes into action.
So there's no conclusive scientific evidence?
Not really.
Really? Okay. Well, stand by, Diane and Nancy, for a moment, because I want to bring in another voice in here briefly. He's Bob Baines, and he's joining us from Spruce Head, Maine. He's a longtime lobsterman and president of the Spruce Head Fishermen's Co-op. Spruce Head is a small fishing town on the southeast coast of Maine. Bob Baines, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I heard that you were out on the waters all day yesterday, so I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. You've been hearing us talk lobsters for a while. There's no way we can have this discussion without talking about the economic importance of this animal to Maine. How has it been up there for lobstermen this year?
Well, it's been a tough year economically. You know, we have a robust fishery. There's a lot of lobsters out there, but with the glut of lobsters that came this summer, the price just plummeted, and we sold, you know, a tremendous amount of our catch at a ridiculously low price.
I was hearing as low as, what, $1, $1.25 off the boats?
$1.50, I think, probably is, you know, what I saw as low as it went for a period of time. It's rebounded, but you know, you can't make up for all those lobsters you sold at that low price, and the price is still 25 cents less than it was this time last year. And last year's price, you know, was not good. We've, you know, the last few years, the price of lobsters have, you know, dropped right out from underneath us. At the same time, our expenses are at record highs.
Mm. So, I mean, you've been hearing, it's so clear that in a place like Maine, where the economy is closely tied to the health of the lobster fishery, that you, as a lobsterman, would be living, breathing, thinking about these animals all the time. But what do you make of the fact that, you know, you're hearing Nancy Fraser earlier telling us about this creature that you're fishing out of the waters for a couple months a year shows up in things like Dutch still life and poetry and surrealist paintings?
Well, it's nothing that I've really associated myself with, but I do know I have a good friend who's a lobsterman down down east further. And he's a poet, and I know there's, you know, there's fishermen who have written songs or written poetry, you know, about lobsters, but that's not really what I do. My goal is just to go out there and try and catch them.
I suppose when you're pulling up traps, poetry isn't necessarily the first thing on your mind.
No.
Let's take a quick call here. John is calling from Hartford, Connecticut. You're on the air, John.
Thank you. I love eating lobsters. And I could really care less about their social life. I realize that cows are herd animals and chickens are flock animals, and I eat them fine. However, as an anatomist, I'm very interested in the physiology of the lobster. And when I cook them, and by the way, here in southern New England, we're having a huge glut on Long Island Sound of soft-shell lobsters. I guess the poor little buggers haven't quite gotten there. Shells together yet, and usually about every 2 weeks I go and buy 16 lobsters at $3.99 a pound in most of the standard supermarkets and then freeze the meat. But what I do not understand is when you examine the tail, mm-hmm. when you break it out of the shell, if you look at the dorsal side of the tail and then pull away the central vein, you notice this lump of stuff, and I'm not exactly certain what it is. Sometimes it's green, sometimes it's red, and it's usually rather hard, and they claim that it's either excrement or it's potentially eggs, and you're supposed to eat it, and I find it absolutely disgusting, but I'm dying to know, what is that junk in the tail?
Okay, John, thank you so much for your call. Bob Baines, let me ask you, is John describing what I've heard up in Maine called the tamale?
No. But I'm going to defer to Diane because she's the scientist and she can tell you exactly what it is.
So, Diane Cowan, what is that green stuff?
Thank you, Bob. Yes, I'd love to explain. When John is taking the tail apart, he's removing the extensor muscles, the small muscle mass, from the flexor muscles, which are the large muscle mass that's ventral. And when you do that, you see a variety of things. If you see a long, thin, black tube, that's the intestine. And you can remove it just like you would devein a shrimp. Mm-hmm. If you see red, waxy stuff that's kind of tough, those are eggs. Unfertilized eggs that haven't been laid or fertilized yet. If you see green, mushy stuff, that's the tamale, which is the lobster's midgut gland.
So
that's it.
And how many of these things are actually edible?
They're all edible, but it's a matter of taste. I devein the lobster and choose not to eat the intestine full of poop, but I eat all the other parts that I've mentioned.
Bob Baines, I know that you've got a lot of lobster traps that need looking after, so I don't want to keep you on the line for too long. But I do wonder, you were talking a little bit earlier about how this year's been a really tough season because of the glut economically. But overall, how is the health of the lobster fishery or the lobster population off the coast of Maine?
Well, as I said earlier, we have a robust fishery. The fishery's in great shape. You know, every year our catch has been increasing. We have a huge, what we call a brood stock of lobsters out there. We V-notch all the egg-bearing lobsters, and we protect the oversized lobsters. And those lobsters are what we call our brood stock, which protects future generations. And there's millions and millions of V-notch and egg-bearing lobsters out there. So the health of the resource is great. And we're going to... It looks like we're going to set another record this year.
Wow.
But even though our catch is increasing, the costs of operating a business, because that's what these are. We're all businessmen, and our profits are, for some fishermen, their profits are still okay because they're making it up in volume. But for the majority of fishermen, their profits are much lower than where they used to be, and it's tough going, and it's unfortunate that we have this great resource that drives the coastal communities that isn't able to pay us, truly what we need to make a decent living.
Hmm. Bob Baines, longtime lobsterman and president of the Sprucehead Fishermen's Co-op, joining us today from Sprucehead, Maine. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us, Bob. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Let's take another call here. Christoph's calling from Boston. You're on the air, Christoph.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling because actually I also love lobsters, but for actually quite different reasons, because I did actually my PhD research on lobsters, and more specifically on the lobster shell. So I research at MIT and in the material science department, and the lobster shell is a really fascinating material.
And why in particular? What's so fascinating that it deserves MIT research?
Because when you think about it, first of all, it has been under development for like some 500 million years. And if you look at a lobster, the lobster shell, I mean, it's an animal skeleton, and it's all basically the same material. And when you think about how many different functions it has to perform, like the claws are different from the body, the tail and the legs, but it's basically one and the other. Basically, it's the same material. It's like a chitin-based composite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extremely, like, sophisticated material. I think there's no, like, man-made material out there that is actually as sophisticated as lobster shell.
Christoph, thank you so much for your call. Nancy Fraser, really interesting call there from Christoph, saying that not only is he, you know, he's charmed by the lobster and what it does for art and science, but particularly as a material. I mean, it seems like the inspiration that this animal is giving people is across the board in more ways than I could have imagined.
Yeah, and the lobster shell is under investigation also at the Max Planck Institute because of the qualities that he mentions and its toughness. And they're looking into ways that we can take advantage of that for the our construction materials. And that's a pretty interesting research going on.
Mm. It's just yet more evidence how science can very frequently find inspiration in nature. Let's take one more call here. Lydia's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Lydia.
Hi, Meghna and guests. How are all of you?
We're doing very well. What's your thought today?
When you were talking about the Annie Hall scene, it put me in mind of one of the most amazing moments of live television ever. And it was in 1982 on Saturday Night Live, and young Eddie Murphy introduced the viewing audience live to Larry the Lobster and asked all of America to call in by a 900 number, which was 25 or 50 cents to place the call at the time, and vote whether Larry would live or be cooked. And the majority of Americans vote, let Larry live. But one woman wrote in a letter that was so overtly racist. She actually used the line, "That man is sick, and I thought those people don't like seafood."
Eddie Murphy,
the following Saturday, responded by cooking Larry the Lobster and eating him on live TV as a payback for her racism. And it was one of the most shocking, striking, powerful moments of live television ever. And, you know, Larry the Lobster sacrifice was, you know, a moment of, you know, racial awareness.
Lydia, thank you so much for your call. Nancy Fraser, do you remember that moment from Saturday Night Live in the 80s?
I have that in the book, and it was an extraordinary thing. The calls were so extensive that they spiked the telephone lines, and they went down briefly. I do know that story, and it is an amazing event. Terrible. Amazing.
Diane Cowan, we've just got a minute or so here to go. I have been charmed by not only the mythology and the artistry of these animals, but also by the science that you're sharing with us. I was wondering if you might very briefly share with us one more fact, and that is that lobsters are known to migrate far and wide, even hundreds and hundreds of miles on the ocean floor.
That's true. The most famous lobster migrations are the spiny lobsters, who actually migrate single file in long lines. Our American lobster here in the Gulf of Maine waters, some migrate, some stay at home, but they too will go distances over 100 miles.
Wow, over 100 miles. And they're very, very sensitive to temperature changes in the water.
Well, yes, they are very sensitive, but the link between temperature and these movements is not as strong as people have thought. Some lobsters don't move, some move, and those who move and don't move are sometimes at the same temperatures, and they're at all kinds of different temperatures. In the winter, we had temperature loggers on lobsters, and on the same day in February, the coldest lobster was minus 1.8 degrees Celsius, which is almost the freezing point of water, while the warmest was at 8 degrees, which is about in the mid-40s. So that's quite a big spread, and lobsters are experiencing throughout the year a great range in temperatures.
I love the fact that this creature, which does end up so frequently on people's plates, still possesses such mystery as well. Diane Cowan joining us from Biddeford, Maine today, marine biologist and founder and senior scientist at the Lobster Conservancy in Friendship, Maine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And Nancy Fraser, author of the new book, I, Lobster, A Crustacean Odyssey. Pleasure to speak with you as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we've got an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org, if you'd like to read more of Nancy Fraser's book. You can also continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Tom Ashbrook. Tom is back tomorrow. This is On Point.